fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle of it. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth for the beginning of the second hour. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Let me tell you about our final guest for this evening. The name is John Lott. He's the author of More Guns, Less Crime. He has a doctorate in economics from UCLA in 1984. He's virtually written over 90 articles in academic journals. His interests are economics, law, crime, public choice, education, writing. He goes on and on. He's very sharp. He was on Coast to Coast last night. I listened to one of the finest interviews I think George Norrie's ever conducted. And I want to welcome to our program John Lott.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, I'm sorry there was a mix-up there on the scheduling a little bit, but I think we put out there Central Standard Time. But anyway,
no problem.
We're very, very honored to have you, John Lott, and we certainly do appreciate your work. And let's start out. How did you get involved in writing this book, More Guns and Less Crime? What was your motivational factors in getting that going several years ago?
Right. Well, I was teaching at the Wharton School of Business, and I was teaching a class on crime. And before that, I'd been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and I'd taught a lot of classes on crime and written economics papers on crime and law enforcement. And some students asked me if I could give a brief discussion on gun control, and I figured, well, you know, why not? But to do that, it kind of forced me to go through the literature. I hadn't really been very interested in the literature on guns up to that point. And I'd seen some of it, but I hadn't systematically gone through it. I guess I'd always assumed that there were better papers someplace else. And I was just pretty shocked by how poorly done the existing research was. Large studies would look at 31 counties from the United States. I could never figure out how you'd pick out 31 counties out of 3,140 counties to look at. And when you're an academic, one of the reasons why you do research is you think you can do a better job than other people have, or you have a new idea, and it's usually the latter. But I thought, you know, it'd be worthwhile to do the study the right way, and it took me a couple of years to put it together and started off as an academic paper and got some attention, and then University of Chicago Press asked me to turn it into a book.
Right. Did your ideas change?
That came out in 98. That came out in 1998. But the third edition just came out in 2010.
All right. Well, then it has sticking power, doesn't it? Staying power, does it? Does it not?
Yeah, no, I'd say so. The third edition has about 300 more pages of material than the first edition had.
What would you say has been this additional research that you've added to the third edition? But also, then you've made it very, very current, have you not?
Well, there are a lot of things that have changed over the last decade. The third edition came out in 2010. The second edition came out in 2000. Over the last decade, we had the sunsetting of the assault weapons ban. You've had a lot of states have stand-your-ground type laws. My research was the first one to look at that. You've had more states adopt right to carry. We now have 41 states that are right to carry. Really a major change in the last few decades. You go back to 1986, You had 21 states that completely banned concealed carry. You had another 20 states, which made it difficult. You basically had to go and get the approval of some public official, like a judge or a sheriff, before they would let you carry a concealed handgun. With the appeals court decision last week and for Illinois, Illinois had been the last state that had banned people being able to carry concealed handguns completely. And the judges said that that was unconstitutional. And so now there'll be 42 states that are right to carry and only eight which require that you have to go and get some type of public official's approval. But all the states have some process for people to be able to carry concealed handguns. So that's a pretty major change since 1986.
Well, I'll say that your book probably had a lot to do with that. Are there legislators that are talking to you and interviewing you all the time about your different proposals and assertions in this book?
Well, I've talked to a number of people. I've testified before state legislators many times. You know, who knows how much impact research has versus other experiences. I mean, surely the fact that permit holders have tended to be extremely law-abiding matters. The most recent data that I've seen for Florida, for example, which is fairly typical, but it has unusually good data on its website, between October 1st, 1987 and the end of June this year, Florida had issued permits to over 2.3 million people, the average person that had their permits for about 13 years. And yet with millions of people having permits and all those years that they had them for, only 168 had their permits revoked for any type of firearms-related violation. The vast majority of those were for two simple reasons. Either one, they accidentally carried their permit concealed handgun into a gun-free zone, like an airport, for example, or a school, or they forgot to have the permit with them when they were carrying. Both of those are considered firearms-related violations, and they lose their permits for that. But 168 out of 2.3 million is only is 0.007 of one percentage point. It's 0.007%. It's pretty tiny, and you know, it's the type of thing you find when you look at other states. Permit holders are extremely law-abiding. They rarely get into any type of trouble, and my guess is it's been very important in having all these different states adopt these rules.
Well, I tell you what, is brandishing a gun a crime in most states?
Well, it depends why you're brandishing it. If you're brandishing it because you're being threatened, then, you know, it's not a problem. If you're brandishing it to threaten somebody, then it's a real problem. Then it's a crime.
Well,
it's a crime
there's so many statistics like that where things are avoided, crimes are avoided by someone brandishing a gun and keeping someone from imposing a crime on them or attacking them. I mean, there's so many different hidden statistics like that, are there not?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the way most crimes are stopped, is not firing the gun. People who use guns defensively very rarely fire the gun. Simply having the gun, simply letting the criminal know that you have a gun, is enough to get criminals to run away and break off the attack. You know, they know the cost of getting involved against somebody who might be able to defend themselves. And, I think you're exactly right. Those are important statistics. And now, the news media doesn't cover those types of cases, even though you may have 95% or so of the time simply brandishing guns sufficient to cause a criminal break off an attack. You know, that's not really newsworthy. Defensive gun uses that get covered are going to be cases when the criminal's been killed.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a break real quick here. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Thank you for being with us this evening, John Lund. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lund.
Thank you.
Okay, on this gun-free zones, can that be rather problematic? And what is the trend in those areas, in universities and, say, public school systems? What kind of information and have you developed in that area?
Right. Well, I'm sure everybody kind of understands the motivations behind having these gun-free zones. The idea is if you simply ban guns from an area, you'll make them safer. The problem is, and this is true for gun control laws generally, is who obeys the laws? And if it turns out that the law-abiding good citizens who don't have guns there, but the criminals do, then you can unintentionally make things a lot worse. You know, I suppose the simplest way to think about this is that if somebody was seriously threatening you or your family, was stalking you, would you feel safer putting a sign in front of your home that said this home is a gun-free zone? My guess is nobody would do that. And the reason is pretty obvious. You don't want to go and tell a criminal who's stalking you, you know, if he's really stalking you, that there's no weapon inside the home in order to try to protect yourself. What that does is that actually serves as an invitation for him to come and go and get you. And, you know, we see this all the time. All these multiple victim public shootings are occurring where guns are banned. You know, you look at something like the Aurora movie theater shooting this summer. There are 7 movie theaters within a 20-minute drive of the killer's apartment that were showing the new Batman movie that was being released. The killer didn't go to the movie theater that was closest to his home. He didn't go to the largest one. He went to the only movie theater that banned permit holders from being able to carry their handguns into the movie theater. And you see that, you know, the Sikh temple, the Portland Mall shooting that just occurred earlier this week, the shooting on Friday. In fact, if you look at all the multiple victim public shootings since at least 1950, with only one exception, all those multiple victim public shootings where more than 3 people have been killed have all taken place where guns are banned. You know, you name a shooting, and it's going to take place where guns are banned. And so, you know, I understand the motivation to try to make things safe, but what's happened is that rather than making those safe areas, they serve as magnets for the criminals to go. That's where they want to do their attack. They want to do their attack where they know that their victims aren't going to be able to defend themselves. And, you know, you look at things, even the Columbine shooting back in 98, you had a situation where the Dylan Klebold in particular, but both of the killers there, were strongly opposed to the concealed carry law. It's my understanding that Lise Klebold was writing a state legislator asking that they not vote in favor of the law. And what few people seem to realize is that the final vote for the state legislature to pass the concealed handgun law there was scheduled the very day that the Columbine attack occurred. And what apparently had upset Klebold the most was that that concealed carry law would have allowed people to carry permanent concealed handguns on high school property, on school property. So, you know, you just see this time after time. They're only usually very small areas in states which are banned, which are posted for you not being able to carry concealed handguns. And yet those are the places where all these attacks are occurring. You know, if it was random, then only a very small percentage of the attacks would be taking place in these gun-free zones. But that's not the case.
You know, you said something earlier in one of your writings there that you've suffered over the years in taking this ban and writing this book, have you not?
Oh, I don't know if I want to get into that too much. I mean, there are a few things, but, you know, things like Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago, when I was at the University of Chicago, he basically threatened the University of Chicago with losing, you know, operations that they were doing with the city of Chicago if they didn't get rid of me and things like that.
Right, so, Well, I didn't want to delve into it too deeply, but, I mean, it seems like that this liberal mindset out here can't let go of the fact that they demonize the gun itself, right, and ignore the individual that has to pull the trigger, right?
Right. Well, I'm not sure I would argue that way from your perspective. The way I would say it is, look, guns do make it easier for bad things to happen. I don't think one should argue against that. But I think the point to make is that guns also make it easier to defend yourself and prevent bad things from happening. And the question is, what's the net effect that's there? Look, my research finds that the police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. I'm convinced about that. But one thing the police will tell you when you talk to them is that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And, you know, they'll tell you themselves that they strongly support letting citizens be able to go and defend themselves when the police aren't able to be there in order to protect them. You look at surveys by the National Association of Chiefs of Police. You have about 78% of those police chiefs around the country support people being able to carry concealed handguns. In fact, they support a national concealed carry, just like a driver's license. If you get a concealed license in Oklahoma or someplace else, just like you get a driver's license there, you should be able to go and drive your car any place and should be able to take your permit concealed handgun when you travel, too. And if you look at street officers are even more supportive. Depending upon the poll, you're often talking about something about 85 to 90% of street officers support citizens being able to carry permitted concealed handguns for protection. They see firsthand the benefits in their own life from having a gun for protection, and they understand why they are important, that they just can't be there all the time to protect people. And so, you know, they understand firsthand the benefits from people being able to carry concealed handguns.
Right. Have there been instances where, at schools and so forth over the years, where individuals had guns in their cars or trucks and went out and stopped even a further carnage? Have there been cases like that?
Oh, there have been many cases like that. You have public schools like Pearl, Mississippi or Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. You have universities like the Appalachian Law School in Virginia, in which an attack was stopped. You have churches like the New Life Church in Colorado a few years ago, where you had one of these mega churches. It was 7,000 people. One of the parishioners there was a former Chicago police officer, but she had stopped doing that years earlier. Her former husband was stalking her, so she had gotten a concealed handgun permit. And she had asked the minister whether it was all right for her to carry a concealed handgun there at church because she was worried that if she didn't have it with her while she was at church, then she would be vulnerable either on her way to church or on her way from church. And the minister said, sure, no problem. And what happened was a killer there killed a couple people in the parking lot. Went into the church, and at that point, this permit holder wounded him, and he committed suicide. But he had like 1,000 rounds of ammunition, and there were 7,000 people in the church.
Right. We've got to take another break, and we'll be right back. Thank you, John Lott. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
I'm George Butler, Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lott.
Well, thank you.
Well, I tell you what, John, you really, you know, done your research on this, and you really have a lot of details and facts at your fingertips. What is the concept and ideas right now on common law right to carry as far as in your vehicle or on your person? Is there any common law rights throughout the country in the 50 states?
Well, it's pretty much determined by statute. And it varies a lot from state to state. There's some states that you don't need to have a permit to carry in your car. There are other states that do require that you have a permit, so it's just, you know, it varies a lot, and just incumbent upon you to kind of know what the rules are.
Right. As far as your studies go from when you first started writing your book, was it 1998? Is that when it was first published, the first edition?
That's correct.
Okay, now you're in your third edition. In the real inner cities, have you seen a major change there in crime? Because of the right to carry or whatever, do you have statistics that would indicate anything like that?
Right. Well, in fact, there are two groups of people who benefit the most from being able to carry. One group are people who are relatively weak physically, women, the elderly. But the second group of people refers to the area that you're talking about, and that is people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. And that's a very well-defined group, unfortunately, in our society. It's poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. I mean, again, it'd be great if the police were there to protect people all the time. And the police are extremely important, but they arrive on the crime scenes after the crime's been committed, usually, and that means that people who are the victims of crime, the most likely to be victims of crime, benefit the most from having guns for protection.
Right. Now, how does this drug culture factor into this? Has this been a really synergistically negative on getting the crime just embroiled and increased in these different areas?
Yeah, well, if you look across the United States, about 80% of the counties in any given year have zero murders. You have about over 70% of the murders in the United States occur in about 3% of the counties. And if you ever live in a major city, you know, whether it be New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or Washington, D.C., often the major newspapers in those areas will go and once a year or so have a map of how murders are distributed in those cities. And they're not all over the place. Even in those places, they're very heavily concentrated in very small areas within those cities. So not only do you have over 70% of murders in just 3% of the counties, but even within that 3%, they're in very tiny areas within that 3%. And a lot of that is drug gang, either directly or indirectly related. And, and that creates lots of problems.
You're saying is on the periphery of some of these drug areas, it makes sense to have a gun handy because you might get caught up inadvertently from some of this drug war going on. I mean, is that good thinking there?
Right. Well, I mean, it's not just the people who are directly in the drug gangs, the fights there, but you have people who are kind of secondary involved who are not exactly the best people to hang around with, and they threaten other people. But that's exactly right. Those are the areas where people benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. You have a lot of people whose lives are messed up in different ways from the drugs. They're probably not the best people to be around. And you have crime for many different reasons in those areas, and those are the people who benefit from protection. One of the things to point out, though, is just as it's very hard to stop illegal drugs from coming into the country, I mean, these drug gangs, it's very hard to stop them getting their drugs. It's also very hard to stop them from getting the weapons that they use to protect their drugs. I mean, here they have something extremely valuable. It's not like if one gang comes over and steals another gang's drugs, the second gang goes to the police and say, could you help us get our drugs back? They have to go and have their weapons there in order to stop the drugs from being stolen to begin with or to take them back. They set up their own little armies. And just as they can smuggle in the drugs, they can smuggle in the weapons that they use to protect those drugs. And so you see countries like that have had gun bans, like Ireland or Jamaica or the UK, they still have plenty of guns in those countries. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that whenever you see gun bans go into place, even in island nations, which you would think would be kind of the ideal experiment for a gun ban, you see increases in murder rates after the ban's been put in place. I can't find a place around the world where we've had gun bans that you don't see an increase in murder and violent crime after the ban's in place there. And the reason is simple. It basically follows along what we were saying at the beginning of the program, and that is the people who obey these laws are the good law-abiding citizens, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm the law-abiding citizens relative to the criminals, you make it easier for those criminals to engage in their crime.
Well, I tell you what, I just wish more more Americans would start catching on to this, because there's a population out there that thinks diametrically opposed to this, is there not?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the media has a big impact on this. People constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns. They rarely, if ever, hear about any of the benefits from guns. And it has a big impact on people's perceptions. I mean, when was the last time you watched ABC, NBC, CBS, or CNN, or MSNBC and heard a story about somebody using guns to protect themselves, protect somebody else? My guess is you've never heard a story on those networks about that. And if you constantly hear about bad things that happen and never hear about any benefits, it has a real impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns. You know, the government does a survey every year to try to figure out how many crimes are committed with guns, because they know not all crimes are reported. And you'll have something like about, 150,000 gun crimes are reported to police each year, maybe 175,000. And there's about 400,000, some years maybe, well, it's about 400,000 right now, gun crimes that are indicated in terms of the surveys. Well, if you do a similar survey in terms of defensive gun use, you find that people use guns defensively to stop crime about 2 million times a year. That means people use guns defensively to stop crime about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year than guns are used in the commission of crime. But few would know that, because they get most of their information from the media and they only hear about the bad things and never about the benefits. But I think the media has a big impact in another way, and that is we have these attacks, whether it be at the Aurora movie theaters or the mall shooting or the school shootings this week. How many people know that those attacks, all as well as all the other ones that they could think of, are occurring where guns are banned? And you know, they just refuse. That's probably the simplest fact that they could go and check, but they never bring it up. Instead, you have them go through things that they're often wrong about. So you have half the people or more believe that the guy who did the Aurora movie theater shooting was wearing body armor. You know, I don't know how many times you hear about the claim that he had a bulletproof vest. Well, he didn't have. First of all, there's no such thing as a bulletproof vest. It's bullet-resistant vest. But even in that case, he didn't have a bulletproof vest. He had something called an assault vest. And what an assault vest is, essentially made out of nylon, which is hardly bullet-resistant, and it has extra pockets so somebody can hold extra magazines to reload his gun. And yet somehow the media has kind of spun that into a bulletproof vest.
Right, okay. John, we've got to take another break. We'll come back to our final segment. Get your thoughts together to give the best advice to the public that you can. We certainly appreciate your being with us this evening. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lott.
Thank you.
Yeah, this last segment, I'm going to give you the floor, and you can tell us what I missed in asking you, or what other very important points that you feel like that we should bring out during this last segment. So you got the floor.
Well, if you want to talk about these mass public shootings, one of the things that's clear when you read the diaries or other documents that these people leave behind or listen to the videotapes is that they're intent on committing suicide. And indeed, 75% of the people who engage in these types of attacks die at the scene. And the other 25%, it's pretty clear that they intended on committing suicide but just couldn't bring themselves to actually kill themselves at the end there. But what they want to do is they want to kill themselves in a way that's going to go and get attention for them. And it's really chilling to go and read what they've written, because they're often very explicit that they realize that they can go and get more. The more people they kill, the more publicity that they can get. And so, you know, the issue basically is, how do you take away that gain that they view in their warped mind that they get from doing these crimes? And there are a couple things to point out. One is they thrive on the attention. They are doing this. They're trying to kill as many people because they believe that's the way they can get more attention. So to the extent to which, and I'm not saying this is something that's going to change, but to the extent to which the media, you know, gives attention to these guys, they are encouraged to do this. If the media tomorrow stopped publishing their names, that would probably reduce to a good extent the rate at which these attacks occur. The second thing is that one of the reasons why they pick these gun-free zones to engage in these crimes is because they know a pretty simple truth, and that is things that I found in my research, and that is the longer the amount of time it takes for somebody with a gun to arrive on the scene to stop them, the more carnage that you're going to have. And the faster you can get a gun there, the sooner you can stop it. And police, you know, 8-minute response time is phenomenal. 5 minutes is unheard of. And yet in 5 minutes or 8 minutes or 10, you can have a world of hurt that's going to be caused in that situation. And so one thing that's proven to be very successful in the cases that we've talked about is to let people have the option to be able to go and defend themselves. You constantly hear fears about, well, will bystanders be shot or what have you, and yet out of all the cases that we talked about where permit holders have stopped these attacks, there's not a single instance where a permit holder has accidentally shot a bystander. You know, people often compare us to Europe. When we have these types of shootings, I often get calls from the media in other countries. But one thing is very clear, and that is Europe actually has about the same rate of multiple victim public shootings that we have here in the United States. It doesn't get the same attention when they occur. And also, I think because you have so many different countries, people don't kind of add them up. But you have to put it on a per capita rate. You just can't compare Norway or Germany to the United States. And when you add them up across all the countries and put it on a per capita rate, they're very similar rates between the United States and Europe. I mean, not only did you have the Norway attack last year in which 69 people were shot to death, another 110 were wounded as a result of the shooting, you know, ignoring the deaths from the bombing that he had. 2 years ago, you had 12 people killed in Britain by a taxi cab driver. You had attacks in Finland at both a mall and a university 2 years ago. France has had numerous attacks over the last few years. Germany, if you look at Germany, Germany has had 2 of the 4 worst public school shootings. And you know, my guess is most Americans wouldn't have a clue about that, yet Germany has extremely restrictive gun control laws. You know, it takes more than a year to go and get a long gun permit. You have to undergo 2 psychological screening tests. But, you know, the problem is that when somebody plans one of these attacks for many months in advance, it's very hard to stop them. And for somebody who wants to die in these attacks, if you combine somebody who wants to die, who's willing to die, and is willing to put the time into making these attacks go, you know, it's very difficult to stop people in those situations. You know, one of the comparisons that you often see made is people will say, well, look at murder rates in the United States and compare them to Britain or to Germany, and our murder rate is significantly higher. And they say, well, we have more guns, and so guns cause the higher murder rate. There's a really pretty obvious problem there, and that is murder rates and crime rates vary across countries for lots of reasons. The most powerful comparison, I think, is to see what happens to an individual country after its gun control laws change. So, for example, before London had any gun control, you had a city of about 8 million people. There were 2 gun murders in 1900. Murder rates have gone up after each of the major gun control regulations have been put in place in Britain. Same with Germany, same with other countries. When you see bans, you see these increases in murder rates. So if you accept the fact that there are many different reasons that murder rates differ across countries, for any individual country, just like it was true for Chicago and Washington, D.C., where we had bans there and saw huge increases in murder rates. You see the same thing across these other countries. So I don't know what else you want me to say, but I mean, I could talk for a while. But.
That is great. You know, I wrote an article in 1999 after the Columbine, and I put it up on my site today. It's called The Schooling. And one of the ideas that I put forward in there is that why don't we take our, just say the public schools, and start giving them gun safety classes in within those public schools, and then get the teachers familiar with how to handle weapons, and let's get principals and some of the key personnel and arm them. What do you think about something like that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I don't see any reason. For states that had right to carry laws prior to 95 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed, it was possible to go and carry permanent concealed handguns on school property. You know, people often seem to think whatever the rules are right now, they're the way they've always been, and that's simply not the case. And yet there were no problems, not one single problem that I've been able to identify or anybody else has identified with all those states that allow teachers and others to carry permanent concealed handguns on school property. In fact, one of the things I mentioned earlier, the first of the public school shootings in Pearl, Mississippi, that was stopped by a permit holder, a guy named Joel Myrick, who's a former Marine, he used to carry a permanent concealed handgun with him when he taught there up until 95 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed. At that time, being a good law-abiding citizen, he stopped carrying it on school property, parked it in his car more than a quarter of a mile off school property. When the attack started in October 1997, he had to run literally a half mile to get his gun, a half mile back, and was still able to hold the attacker at point-blank range on the ground for 11 minutes before the police arrived. But, I mean, that's an example of a teacher who used to carry his permanent concealed handgun on school property. And if he had still been able to do it as a result of the law, if the federal law hadn't changed there, he probably would have been able to stop the attack much sooner than he actually did.
Right. What I'd like to see, instead of gun-free zones, gun-protected zones, meaning the school.
Right, well.
See?
Well, I mean, I have no problem with that. I think adults, whether it be university level or any school, any place, the problem is, when you create these gun-free zones, those are the places these criminals attack.
Right. Well, I tell you, I just wish we could get, we need this media to start waking up to some of the information in your fine book here.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you letting me talk about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, John Lott, for being with us this evening. We certainly appreciate what you've done in this area. We certainly do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good night.
We're going to end the program with Sean Hannity, and he's got some important guests this last Friday night, and he's got Newt Gingrich in there, I think, his last interview. So listen very closely to this. This is very important stuff. But good night, and God bless every one of you. We're just going to end the program with Sean Hannity's clips here. Thank you.
Isn't one murder, isn't one rape enough? Because the numbers of violent crimes are in the hundreds of thousands, Geraldo, over the years.
First of all, Sean, we had a little earthquake here in California today, 5.3 on the Richter scale.
That's because you're out
your
there.
Your opening monologue was a lot tougher than the earthquake. I also want to say before I start that I share your enthusiasm that the president's approval ratings have now ticked up, and indeed, in at least one survey, are above 50% for the first time during
51.
His presidency. 51. But I do believe, and this is where I know that you and I disagree, and I disagree with when most of the audience watching me right now will disagree. I think that this immigrant crisis is manufactured. I think is an overreaction to that so-called caravan of 1,000 that is now broken up in the southern city of Oaxaca, and they're between Oaxaca and Puebla. They're all now seeking asylum in Mexico. They're not coming this way.
You've seen the tape. I've sat through a security briefing in a 7-year period of time, including murder and rape and other violent crimes. 642,000 crimes in total. You've seen me play the tape. How could you say that that's being overstated?
I say it with absolute certainty. I say it that immigration, illegal immigration across the southern border is near 46-year lows. We did have a spike in March, probably having to do with the demand for agricultural workers here in the southwestern part of the country.
If one woman gets raped or one Kate Steinle gets murdered, isn't that enough that we protect our family, our fellow Americans first?
Sean, it absolutely is. I was listening to Mark Stein the other night, and he had a great comment. He said, you know, it's odd. If you're an American citizen entering back into America at an airport, you know, you get a damn cavity search at the border by our own people. And yet you have people who just casually walk across the southern border, narco traffickers. We know terrorists are aware of the southern border. I know Geraldo and I had a beef about this the other day, but it's true. It's a fact. I know they're aware of the southern border. People have died. And Sean, there's a real price to illegal immigration. I don't know why Geraldo keeps denying that.
There 20 seconds, Geraldo. That is not fair. That is not fair. I do not deny that there is crime committed against these poor, vulnerable people coming from the South, fleeing disrupted economies, drug cartels, gangsters, murder. They're seeking
what
a better life, just
economy,
as our
Geraldo.
Immigrant parents sought a better life here.
We got a break.
I get that.
Thank you both.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No. Thank you both. The great one, Mark Levin, coming up.
We are told that Mueller wants to interview the President of the United States, who knows nothing, who has been a witness to nothing, who is not a target of the investigation. What we are seeing now is conduct by two public officials, Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein, that is unethical, unprofessional, an embarrassment to the United States government, and is undermining equal enforcement of the law.
Both
this
you,
is a perjury trap. Plain and simple.
I agree with
this
the perjury
is nonsense.
Trap point.
Mm-hmm. This is absolutely
right.
Outrageous. It should end right now.
Former U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova on this program last night just eviscerating the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and Robert Mueller. And the mainstream media, by the way, also deserves blame. Joining us now, George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. He has a great column up on thehill.com entitled, When Will the Media Accept That Trump Is Not a Criminal Target? Professor, I'll let you answer your own question. they seem not to want to accept that reality. It's been over a year we've been looking into this in a lot of varying ways.
Yeah, there's a troubling pathology in the news where people seem to be unwilling to cover what is positive news for President Trump. There's not positive news as well, but that rather one-sided account is getting increasingly alarming. The fact is that there is not a strong, credible case of crime that is emerging from this investigation. After a year, after hundreds of thousands of documents that have been turned over, after multiple cooperating witnesses, after dozens of criminal counts, none of those filings have created a nexus between a criminal act and the president, or even the campaign for the most part.
And collusion, Professor, is not a crime, is it?
It's not. And, you know, we went through months where people were arguing, were talking as if there was a collusion crime. But the interesting thing is, look, in collusion and obstruction, you have an exceptionally weak case that has emerged so far. On collusion, there is an absence of evidence. There's just simply an absence of anything connecting the president or the campaign. The last major filing said that no Trump official knowingly engaged Russians in their hacking aspect of their intervention. There could be new evidence, but we haven't heard of it. On the issue of obstruction, I think the president has what may be insurmountable defenses. He can easily argue that he fired Comey for cause.
Rosenstein recommended it, too. He'd be witness number one, which I think conflicts him out of the whole deal and even the appointment of Mueller. Let me ask you this. If there's no underlying crime, Professor, which you're saying and asserting there isn't, and he has the right to fire anybody, and there's no crime of collusion, and why would any lawyer allow a sitting president to be questioned by a special counsel?
Well, Sean, first of all, we need to be careful. Obviously, we don't know what Mueller has. There may be more crime evidence. There may be more allegations to make, but we haven't seen them so far, and that's quite telling. And the president's status hasn't changed in a year. He was a subject before. He still is a subject and not a target. But as for the sit-down, it's going to be hard for the president not to do that. The good news is that Mueller's asking about four categories where I think his defenses, the president's defenses, are the strongest. They're sort of frontal attacks where the armor is the thickest. I think that he could sit down and thread that needle if he listens to his counsel and prepares for it.
But why should he have to, I guess, is the question. I'll ask Mark Levin that. What about Article 1 that literally empowers Congress for oversight purposes in the government? And I only have about 25 seconds. Doesn't the DOJ have to cooperate? These subpoenas went out in August of 2017.
Right. No, I agree with you on that. I've been a long advocate of congressional oversight authority. I think Congress rolls over too readily. This has been too long. That material should have been turned over. I'm not too sure why it has not. But at some point, Congress has to think about using some of its inherent authority to say this isn't
maybe
just
contempt.
A voluntary act. You know, we are an equal branch of government.
Yeah, co-equal, supposedly. All right. Professor, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, when we come back, the great one, Mark Levin, weighs in on whether the president should ever talk to Robert Mueller. That's next. All right, joining us now, the host of CRTV, Levin TV, and the host of Life, Liberty, and Levin, right here on the Fox News Channel. As a matter of fact, this weekend, Governor Palin is going to be your guest on the show. I've always liked Governor Palin, and we haven't heard from her
She's
in a while.
I
look forward to watching, Mark. All right, so the big question now is what the president needs to do. Apparently, the president's lawyers are negotiating with the special counsel over the idea that the president would speak with Robert Mueller. The president himself is like, I have nothing to hide. I'd speak with him. But if there's no underlying crime, if collusion is not a crime, and the president has the right to fire Comey or anybody else, and even Comey admitted as much, then the question is, you know, if they want to get into the president's mindset, your thoughts can't represent a crime, in my opinion. You're the constitutional expert. Would you allow, if the president was your client, would you allow him to speak to Robert Mueller?
No. And let me tell you, I wouldn't allow him to speak for his sake and for the sake of the office of the presidency. Because this is a rogue prosecutor who's investigating nothing. Do you understand that? He's investigating nothing. There's no underlying crime. When he got his appointment by the deputy attorney general did not provide any basis for the appointment. That is, he didn't say, here are the criminal statutes I want you to investigate, because there aren't any. I want to make a point that I don't believe anybody else has made, and this is very, very important for the president and for the president's lawyers and the nation. The official position of the United States Department of Justice under a Democrat administration and a Republican administration was set out by the Office of Legal Counsel, that's the constitutional office within the Department of Justice, in two memoranda. And these memoranda say that a president of the United States cannot be indicted while he's in office. Cannot be indicted while he's in office. So he can't be a criminal target. The president of the United States can't be a criminal target because he can't be indicted. That's the official position of Mr. Mueller's bosses over there at the Department of Justice. That's number one. Number two, I keep hearing, well, what if he's subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury? Subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury. Well, then you go to the federal judge. And you say to the federal judge, Your Honor, my client can't be indicted. That's the position of his bosses. So why is he going in front of a federal grand jury? Well, we need him as a witness. A witness to what? What criminal statute or what criminal violations do you think he was a witness to that he needs to testify to? Well, we think he may have committed obstruction. And even though we may not charge him, excuse me, Mr. Mueller, this is a criminal grand jury. This isn't being done so you can issue your report. So there are many constitutional obstacles, of course, to this argument that the president obstructed justice. So firing a subordinate is obstructing justice? That's absurd. If that's obstructing justice, then when Mr. Mueller fired Mr. Stroke, maybe that's obstruction of justice, too, interfering with an investigation. What I'm saying is, when I watch people come on TV and say, well, he can be subpoenaed. Well, anybody can be subpoenaed. He's the president of the United States, and you damn well better have a strong reason for trying to drag him in front of a grand jury. That's number one. Number two, a federal judge is not going to just accept that kind of a spectacle, and Mr. Mueller knows it. That's why they're trying to negotiate and reach some kind of a deal. You're going to drag a president who's dealing with all these issues all over the world, who's dealing with China and Russia and North Korea and Iran and so forth and so on, and bring him in front of a grand jury? A judge is not going to want that kind of a constitutional crisis. That's why Mr. Mueller's trying to negotiate some basis to interview Mr. Trump. But if I were Mr. Trump, I'd say, you know what? I didn't do anything wrong, and that's exactly why I'm not talking to you. That's number one. I'm going to protect this office for Democrats and Republicans who are elected president of the United States. That's number two. And you have crimes that you want to prosecute? Go for it, baby. But I didn't commit a crime. I'm not going to be indicted. I'm not going to be dragged in front of a federal grand jury. And that's that. That's what the president should say.
Let me ask you this next question, because I think this is key. And there's been very few of us that have done this deep dive into this, I would argue, corrupt team that Robert Mueller's put together. Everyone can say he is beyond reproach. Well, I look at his handling in the anthrax case post 9/11. I look at, you know, the case when he was in Boston as it relates to Whitey Bulger. Four innocent people went to jail. $100+ million settlement. Two of those guys, two of the four died in jail. Then you got this guy, Andrew Weissman, the New York Times calls him Mueller's pit bull. Okay, that's a guy that as a result of his actions, twice was excoriated by judges for withholding exculpatory evidence. Tens of thousands of jobs were lost at Anderson Accounting for no reason at all.
Right.
Overturned 9-0 in the Supreme Court. You and I both know that doesn't happen a lot. And a guy that sent four Merrill executives to jail, Mark, four, for a year. And that was overturned by the Fifth Circuit. Wait a minute. Why would Robert Mueller, with his background, be appointing only Obama, only Hillary, only DNC donors, and corrupt people like Weissman to his team to be his pitbull?
And why are the Democrats so keen on him? And why are the media so keen on him? And there's lots of leaks coming out of this operation, too. Among them to the Washington Post the other day is he wants to put a report out by June or July where they're probably going to suggest the president of the United States committed obstruction of justice. Not only is that outrageous, to the extent he does a report, it's supposed to be to the deputy attorney general on the crimes he's found or the crimes he's prosecuting. He's not supposed to give opinions. Let's be clear about something. The media treat this guy like he's a judge. He's not a judge. He's a prosecutor. And there's two sides to every argument. That's number one. Number two, he's going to put out a report accusing the president of the United States of obstruction of justice, when in fact that means that the president of the United States will be accused of obstruction of justice for impeachment purposes. That leak should tell the president of the United States everything he needs to know, which is that Mueller is out to destroy him.
All
He's
right.
out to write a report to give it to the Democrats in the House of Representatives.
We only have a little over a minute left. And I would argue he'd be stepping right into a perjury trap if there's no underlying crime and they can't indict the president.
Defend the office of the presidency and defend yourself.
Well said. That's why we call you the great one. Rod Rosenstein, he shouldn't even be in this position. Number one. Number two, isn't he conflicted out if he's the number one witness as it relates to obstruction with Comey because he wrote a letter recommending such? And in fact, he signed on to this, extended this FISA warrant himself, knowing that this was bought and paid for, Hillary propaganda, Russian lies, and then appoints Mueller. How does he get away with that conflict? How do you see him in all this?
I see him as very bizarre and really out of line. In addition to everything you've said, we now know that when Mueller went into Mr. Manafort's apartment at 5 or 6 in the morning, when he and his wife were in bed with the FBIs with their guns drawn, he got a warrant from a federal judge. When he went in there, gathered information, and then he goes to the deputy attorney general a week later to have his authority expanded to cover what he had just done a week before. So Mr. Rosenstein expands his authority to cover the tracks for Mueller, who was doing things he shouldn't have done. And the reason why this is important, America, is this. Mr. Rosenstein is not the Attorney General of the United States.
Well said.
And he's acting like it.
All right, Sunday night, 10 p.m., Life, Liberty, Levin. Governor Palin will be Mark's guest, and you don't want to miss it. I'm watching every week. Thank you. Great one. Appreciate it. When we come back, incredible ugliness from the left. You won't believe what they're saying about President Trump, Republicans. This crosses even a new line. Newt Gingrich is next. Straight ahead. All right, so the left's hatred for Republicans and President Trump, it knows no bounds. Just listen to what California Senator Kamala Harris joked about with Ellen DeGeneres earlier today.
If you had to be stuck in an elevator with either President Trump, Mike Pence, or Jeff Sessions, who would it be?
Does one of us have to come out alive?
One of us have to come out alive. And then yesterday, Robert De Niro, he was asked about the success of the Roseanne reboot. He took a shot at the president and said, quote, we're at a point with all of this where it's beyond trying to see another person's point of view. There are ways that you can talk about that. But we're at a point where the things that are happening in the country are so bad, and it comes from Trump. There are so many people who have left this administration. It's a serious thing. So I don't care about Roseanne. Well, sounds like De Niro isn't happy that there finally is a TV show that actually appeals to Americans that they actually want to watch. With reaction, the author of the best-selling book, Vengeance, he's been incognito. He's been missing in action. Former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, welcome back, sir. How are you?
Well, it's good to be with you. And the fact is, we're in the middle of a cultural civil war, and the language is the language of a civil war. People say horrendous things. And they mean them. I mean, I think on the left, the level of hostility at every single zone. If you look at people like Marco Rubio being charged with, he's responsible for murder if he takes money from the NRA. I mean, this is the kind of horrific language that makes it impossible to bring people together because they really are that far apart.
Yeah. So the president's not a target. We learned that. And we know that the Washington Post even reporting, all right, the Mueller's unlikely to indict Trump, a sitting president. Collusion isn't a crime. And I'm watching all of this unfold, and he's going to issue a series of reports on all of this. And then we see this whole other side where Hillary steals a primary. Then Hillary has the fix, and we know she deleted, acid washed, subpoenaed emails, breaks up, you know, different devices, all that happens. Then we find out she's the one that paid for the phony Russian dossier. You have the cover-up of the crime she committed with Comey, Strzok, Page, McCabe, and of course, Loretta Lynch. And then they lie to a FISA court. We have real evidence and real proof. No evidence of Trump-Russia collusion. But that's all the rest of the media talks about. And then, of course, the president has a lot of success stories. Nobody talks about that either. Why?
Well, let me go back to a very simple model. We're in a cultural civil war. If you are the left, you never talk about your side's weaknesses, and you never acknowledge the other side's strengths. And, of course, what's happening to the left is if you're an average American, you see more jobs every month, more investment every month. You see Trump doing what he promised he would do. You see him standing up for America. And your choice is left-wingers who think it's okay to have thousands of people cross the border versus protecting America. You know, inch by inch, Trump is actually organizing, exactly like Andrew Jackson, a majority that I think will get him reelected and that will actually be decisive in changing America's future.
All right, so you wrote a column, Mitch McConnell out there saying, oh, Republicans are going to face strong headwinds. We hear from anybody else in the media, a big blue wave is coming in November. You believe Republicans can win in November. I think there's a lot at stake, not the least of which, if Pelosi becomes Speaker, they would want to impeach Donald Trump, and they'll make up a reason if they have to. So the question is, what do the Republicans need to do? It's April, from now till November, to win.
Well, let me remind everyone, having spent a lot of my years, as you know, as an old friend, campaigning, I was behind 51-37 in September in my third campaign, having lost twice. I won that election 54-46. George H.W. Bush was behind in May by 19 points, won in November by 6. That means one out of every five Americans switched between May and November. Now, why do I say that? We're a long way from the 2018 election. If we end up with the anti-tax cut Democrats, the anti-Semitic Democrats, the socialist Democrats, the nutcake Democrats, the people who have no positive solution for anything,